Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Dwanza. Great to be back with you. It's a beautiful day, and I know that you are enjoying it. At least that's the plan. I certainly hope that you're enjoying it. I said that's the plan, no pun intended. We're going to be talking about the plan today, the business plan. If you know that, as you know, my special guest today is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We've actually shortened the distance between shows. Well, Professor, he used to come on once a month, but this information is so good, I could not have you all wait a whole month to have him back. So we're going to be doing it every 2 weeks, okay? So my special guest today is author. He's just, I mean, he's just an entrepreneur, and I know that you entrepreneurs out there are loving the shows that you're hearing with Professor Geiger. He's written two awesome books, actually, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, and Finding a Career for Life. So I encourage you all to go back in the archives and to scroll down and find Professor Geiger, and where you see his name, all you have to do is click and listen to those shows. I guarantee you, if you're an entrepreneur, you're going to be definitely rewarded for the time spent listening. If you're new to the show, let me tell you a little bit about Professor Geiger. I'm currently retired. Professor Joseph Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Well, over the course of his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. Sounds like he already knew what he wanted to do before he had actually graduated college. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. In order to help people to succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 101 Practical Business Principles, but the principle, he just keeps adding principles, and the book keeps growing, and so we're blessed to, again, have him as my guest today. He now lectures and teaches seminars at the University of Richmond, located in Richmond, and I'm telling you, if you're an entrepreneur, you definitely need to get the book that we're going to be talking from today, and we'll tell you about how you can do that as the show progresses. Welcome back, Professor. Great to have you as my guest again today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You know, Professor, I want to share with the listeners, as off the air, we were having a conversation just before the show came on, and it's great info, and as I was asking you the question, I'd like to share that conversation with the listeners. I was asking you about nonprofits, and is the business plan and the cash flow forecast, would that be the same for a nonprofit entity? Could you share your response with me for that?
Yes, I will, and it would be. The only real difference is that a nonprofit does not pay taxes on the excess money that it collects over and above what it costs to pay the light bill and the employees and the advertising and all that, where a for-profit does. But short of that, I don't see that there's a difference. So that if you're working my daughter is in charge of fundraising for National Geographic, and the funds that she raises are those that are over and above what it takes to pay the light bill and the employees and all that, goes to the causes. In other words, research that they do on everything from the natural world on and on. They no longer own the magazine. That's been sold off to Fox Partners. And so that is actually published by Fox, but they get a fee from Fox for the magazine. And then my daughter collects money on the Internet and a variety of other ways, and that goes into the pot, and from that they pay all of their expenses. But they don't pay for a profit to the taxes to the federal government for anything they make over and above. But short of that, I don't see that there's a difference. Now, there are some nonprofits that that don't do that so much. There are some fairly famous ones that collect money and the vast majority of the money goes to the people who are doing the collection. There's some nonprofit sites that you could go to, and I can't remember what they are right now, but if you Google nonprofits, you'll probably find them. And they'll tell you those that collect money, and most of it goes to the people who are trying to collect the money. There are others that even the CEO takes virtually no money. If you give money to at Christmas time to the people outside of stores that are ringing a bell and so on, and I skip my mind now what they are, but that one, the president of it, although it is a multi-billion-dollar business, he gets $12,000 or $13,000 a year. That's what he gets, his total amount. There are others that the CEO gets $1. They have to pay him $1, so there's consideration, and therefore it's a legitimate expense. But then there are those who the CEO gets millions. And so you can judge for yourself how that is. But the big difference is that they do not pay taxes on monies over and above their actual expenses.
Interesting. So a person who actually decides that they wanted to start a nonprofit business, as you mentioned before, it's normally for a cause. They're not going into it, whereas the average entrepreneur might be thinking about, oh, I can retire, you know, I can retire rich and, you know, go live on an island somewhere possibly. That's these people who are starting the nonprofit, if they actually have the time to devote to that and are only getting paid a dollar or, you know, in some cases, $13,000 a year, they're already, I would assume, pretty well off already to even be in a position to have that time to do that.
I think that's absolutely true. Now, there are those who start nonprofits thinking that they can skim the money off and pay themselves big salaries and you know, all kinds of stuff. There are those out there who do that. And in my view, they're not a legitimate nonprofit, but they still are C3A, federal tax in the tax laws, and so they don't pay. But the legitimate ones, the people like the Red Cross. Now, the Red Cross pays a big salary to the president of the Red Cross. I don't know why they do that, because quite frankly, I think they could easily get retired CEOs, very wealthy people who are very, very successful, a proven success, and they would be happy to work for the Red Cross for a dollar a year. But they historically don't do that. However, the vast majority of the funds that the Red Cross takes in goes to their cause, which is helping in disasters and helping people. So it's very much a legitimate one.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, Professor. I'm sure that there, you know, again, that was just a conversation that Professor and I were having just before showtime. And I wanted to share that conversation with the listeners because I'm sure that there are people out there that, you know, can appreciate, you know, just that tidbit of information that you just got from Professor Geiger. Well, today we're going to be talking about, this is going to be actually part two of the section that we started 2 weeks ago, and it's on the business plan. In part one, Professor outlined the importance of the business plan. I mean, it is actually absolutely paramount, imperative that you write a business plan, that, again, you write the business plan. You don't pay somebody to write the business plan. You need to know what you're writing. You need to know the nuts and bolts of your business, and the way to do that is to understand it, and you have to write the business plan yourself. Well, today we're going to be delving into part two of that conversation, and we're going to be starting with principle number 14, and that is, if your plan isn't organized, you are not organized. Professor?
Yeah, that's the reason I put it that way is because there's people who invest in businesses And you, as a founder of the business, you're an investor. You may not invest your money, although you probably will invest some of it. But people who invest in startups, they are interested in two things, basically. They're interested, is the idea a legitimate idea? Does it have profit potential? That's the first. And secondly, are the people who are starting it capable of running the business, starting the business and running it in such a way that there will be profits? Because if they're not, chances are the investor doesn't want any part of it. And what you'll find if you talk to investors, if they look at your business plan and they say, well, this is a pretty mediocre opportunity, but the people who are presenting it are really well organized, their thoughts are organized, it's a great presentation, but it's just not something for me, very likely they'll tell you that. And they'll say, this business plan isn't for me, but let me tell you, if you have another idea, you have another opportunity, bring it to me because I'm interested in you. If, on the other hand, when the people read it, and let's say they decide that it is a good opportunity, but the way it's presented is poorly presented. I don't mean that the writing doesn't sound like Shakespeare. The writing, the ideas are disjointed. It is not organized. They'll basically tell you, thank you very much for presenting it, but I'm not interested. They probably are not going to tell you why they're not interested, because generally speaking, these kind of folks are the type that just wouldn't do that sort of thing. They are not going to say, hey, you're a dummy. You're poorly organized, and maybe they should, but they probably won't. So if your plan isn't organized, you're not organized, and so you should be pretty careful in the in what you present to them, because if your plans and your ideas are not well structured, that's the one thing that is common amongst successful entrepreneurs. Their minds are organized. The way they present thing is organized. It is logical. It steps follow steps. They don't leave big holes. So whether the plan is for a ladies ready to wear, or it's for a new type of cell phone, it doesn't make any difference. The person presenting it, if they're going to be successful, has got to be very, very well organized. And so that's a reason for the way I stated it.
Well, what about, people who are just new to being an entrepreneur and they're writing the business plan and, they don't know that it's not, that their thoughts aren't, that their thoughts are running together and that it's not very well structured. They don't know that. Maybe their audience might have been their brother or their sister, as they might have been, running it past them. Hey, how does this sound? And the person that they're running it past and giving them advice and saying, oh, yeah, it sounds good to me, might not be an entrepreneur or have any experience in that. And I guess that's where people like organizations like SCORE comes in that you talked about, maybe.
Yep.
Getting an audience, maybe even with one of the mentors in an organization like SCORE that can actually, at least would you advise that someone like that review your business plan?
Oh, yeah.
Before you.
Yeah, somebody like that, somebody who you know, who you trust, who will tell you the unvarnished truth, but who is not intimate with what your opportunity is. And that's what you don't want, somebody who knows it upside down and backwards, because they don't need your presentation. They already know it. You need somebody who doesn't know it and who is willing to tell you the unvarnished truth. And so if they can read it and understand it, even though they don't know anything about that, you're perhaps on the right track. SCORE is a good place to start, or it might be even a better place to finish after you have shown it to some people who, like I say, who you know, but who don't know anything about the opportunity. Because what you want is something that makes good sense, that you're not leaving out things, you're not assuming things, you're not assuming that the person who is reading it already knows that. So that's kind of what you want. And SCORE, before you start presenting it to an investor, SCORE would be a great kind of a final shot to go to them and say, what do you think of this? And they'll read it, they'll tell you the truth, and basically they'll tell you the truth even if they know you're not going to like the truth.
For those who might not know what SCORE is, Professor, could you share with our listeners about SCORE for those who might be tuning in for the first time and they are hearing SCORE for the first time? Can you share with our listeners about the organization SCORE?
Yeah, SCORE was started after the Second World War. S-C-O-R-E stands for Senior Corps of Retired Executives. And that's what it stands for. It used to be worded out, but now they just say SCORE. But that's what SCORE stands for. There's well over 300 SCORE chapters throughout the United States. If you type in SCORE.org, you can go there and you can find the chapter close to you. They're virtually everywhere. I grew up in a little town in Newton, Kansas, and there's a SCORE chapter in Wichita, which is 25 miles south. There's another SCORE chapter in, or at least there was, in Hutchinson, Kansas, which is a town of 30,000 or 40,000 now, and that's about 30 miles to the west. So they're everywhere. Juwanza and I both live in Richmond, Virginia, and the 12th SCORE chapter that was originally formed, the 12th one, is here in Richmond. So this one is one of their very early SCORE chapters. And they have people volunteer, and they're basically folks who are usually retired or getting close to retirement, have extra time, and have a city sensibility that they want to give back to folks and to young entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs who are not so young who need help. And there, it costs you absolutely nothing. It's free.
Wow, you can't get a better deal than that. I mean,
nope,
free advice.
Priced right.
Price is right, for sure.
Yeah.
Professor, could you talk about also the need to not take the, I don't even like want to use the word criticism, the evaluation personal. If, for example, you talk to a SCORE mentor or somebody and they share with you that the business plan that you presented, in spite of how much effort you may have put into writing it, might just not cut the mustard, not to take that personal, but to take it as a plus, because, you know, by hearing that information, you can actually go back and tweak it and make the necessary corrections so that you do have a plan that's executable, but not to take it personal and think that, oh, they don't know what they're talking about, or, you know, just to take it in the wrong way, but to be teachable and to, you know, have the right attitude towards the information that's shared with you from people that have actually been in business for a long time.
Yeah, they have, just remember, they have nothing to gain. They're not going to take your idea and steal it and start a company following your idea. I mean, if they did that, SCORE as an organization would come down on them like a ton of bricks. As a matter of fact, if one of their mentors did that, you could probably go to SCORE and they would be happy to pay for the legal fees to sue the guy or gal, as the case may be, because that would really, really show, you know, they very, very poorly with SCORE. SCORE, by the way, is generally aligned with the Small Business Administration of the federal government. Here in Richmond, the SCORE offices are across the hall from the SBA, Small Business. So they're connected with government. They just would not tolerate that. So the information you get, the criticism that you get from them is offered in all honesty. where they're really trying to help you. And if you want to take it badly, well, I guess go ahead and take it badly, but that's not the spirit in which it is given. It is given with an effort to try to help you, not to to do anything. And like I say, you don't have to worry at all. If you have the next apple in your ideas, you do not have to worry about somebody at SCORE trying to pilfer that and execute it. They just are not going. That's just not going to happen.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph Geiger, author of two fabulous books, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles, as well as Finding a Career for Life. We're going through Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, principle by principle. Now, we're going to tell you how you can get the book. Okay, we're not going through it principle by principle so that you don't get the book. I mean, because there's so much more in the book. I mean, I know it's hard to believe that as much information that Professor is sharing during the interview. I mean, this is a book with 105 business principles. Okay, there's so much here that you really have to get the book and read it to really appreciate what Professor Geiger is sharing. As awesome as his presentation is, as awesome as the information is, I guarantee you, you will not regret getting the book. As a matter of fact, you will read it more than once. And then you'll share it with somebody else because you'll be so impressed with the information and you'll see the benefit in it. Again, we're going through the book principle by principle, and we're now up to principle number 15. Business plans are written for the entrepreneur. Now, you just heard myself and Professor Geiger talk about SCORE and having a business plan and letting somebody review the business plan. But the business plan is written for you. Okay, Professor, would you elaborate?
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think that a business plan is written for investors or for bankers, and sure, you'll use it for that if you need investors and bankers, but it is actually written for you. The purpose of the principles that I have are I try to make them where they're executable. In other words, they're not just a bunch of fuzzy theory. There's something that you can, as they say, take to the bank, which is not your bank, but it's to take to your business, and you can actually do them. The reason for a business plan is written for the entrepreneur is to dissuade people from thinking that it is really written for investors. You may or may not need investors, but you're certainly going to need a roadmap in order to make your business plan work. And one of the really sad things about entrepreneurship is that essentially half of the 600,000 plus businesses that are started in the U.S. every year, half of them will fail by the end of their first 12 months. And another half of the remaining will fail in the next 2 years. So, and the reason that they fail is basically they run out of money. Why did they run out of money? Is because they haven't done their planning. They haven't written a plan, and a plan really has two parts, as we've talked about before, but I'll just skim through it very quickly again. The first part is what we're talking about now, which is a story about the opportunity, business opportunity that you found. And the second part is a month-to-month cash flow forecast to try to figure out what your expenses will be on a month-to-month basis for at least the first year and what your income will be in those same months. And what you want to make sure is your income stays ahead of your expenses, because if it doesn't, you're broke. And if you go broke, you cannot pay your bills, but the money comes in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later, it doesn't make any difference because you're broke. You're already out. You're done. You're through. So if you've done your planning well and done the cash flow forecast well, you will figure out that you will not be broke, and you will have that down. And the only way you can do that is to do it yourself. Now, you may need some help. SCORE will be happy to help you. My book will certainly help you go through it yourself on a month-to-month basis, because I do that in the book. I take you through a business on kind of a monthly basis, so you can see what the expenses are in a actual business, and what goes wrong and what doesn't go wrong. So that's why you should do it, and that's the reason for this principle. The business plan is written for the entrepreneur.
You know, it's got to be nothing more embarrassing than someone being asked, what type of business are you? What type of business is your business? And the person can't explain it. You know, that's got to be a very awkward situation to be in. I mean, if the person is stumbling and stuttering and fumbling for words that, you know, trying to describe their business, as a rule of thumb, how long should it take a person to be able to describe their business, Professor? I mean, if not talking to an investor, of course, where you actually have set an appointment to sit down and talk, possibly have maybe allocated an hour or so to discuss whatever, but just on average, somebody comes up and says, oh, I heard you're into so-and-so now. Tell me about your business.
My view is that you ought to be able to do it in 10 words, maybe 20. If it's done right, it is, it's in the name, and you can just say the name and then they know it. Pizza Hut. What business is Pizza Hut in?
Mm-hmm.
How much do I have to explain already? They make pizzas. What business is University of Richmond in? Well, they're in the business of being a university. Where are they? In Richmond. So it should be, if you do it right, you understand it, you ought to be able to do it in very, very few words. I had a company at one time called Orca Yachts. What does Orca Yachts do? It makes yachts, and they're called Orca. So, you know, that once you've done that, and you ought to be able to do it with maybe a picture and two words, or certainly not more than a dozen words. In the case of Orca Yachts, I had a picture of one of my yachts running offshore and the name, and you could just hand people your card, and they knew what you did. It didn't take any words. So that's how you should have it down to where you can do that. Ladies ready to wear. You don't call it Three Sisters. You might have, you know, Three Sisters Dress Shop, something like that. By the time you've said the name, you're already about 80% of explaining what you do. And so it should be where it's very easy, and most businesses can be explained that way. So now there's some that come up with these made-up names, Xerox. What the heck's Xerox? Well, Xerox is a printing company, but they, in my view, they would have been better to name it IBM, International Business Machine, and then they'd know what it is. But people come up with silly names, and in my view, a silly name is silly because it's going to cost you lots of money to try to explain it to people where you ought to be able to explain it in just a very, very few words.
Everybody, if you're listening online, all you have to do is call in at 347-324-5727 and press 1, and I can bring you on. If you're already listening on the phone and I see you up there on the phone, all you have to do is press 1 if you have a question, and I can bring you on and let you talk with Professor Geiger. Again, we're going through the book principle by principle, and we are now up to principle number 16, which is, the fatal flaw will probably be in the assumptions. The fatal flaw will probably be in the assumptions, Professor.
Why don't we go? You're looking at the old book with 101 or two principles. Let's look at the new book with 105, and number 16 is finding financing. And I have it three ways. The number 16 is now finding financing. the traditional way. And so that's kind of the next thing that comes up after you've figured out your business plan. You have written the business plan, the story of the business, and then you've done a cash flow forecast so you know how much money you'll need and when you'll need it. And at that point, you can look and see, well, I need $100,000, and I need half of it within the first month, and I need the other half within the other next 6 months. So how do you go about coming up with your money? And so let me start with saying that in between 2007 and 2015, admittedly, those were years that the country's economy was not running high speed, but it was still going pretty well. And there was an average of 600,000 new businesses formed every year. So where did the money come from to pay for those businesses? And slightly over 90% of it, 90.5% of it, during those years, according to the IRS, actually the Bureau of Labor Statistics using IRS data, the funds for it came from the founders, their family, and their friends. And of the 600,000, an average of 543,000 came up with the money, and that's where they found it, in the family and friends. I should say one other thing here, that if you as a founder do not have, we call it skin in the game, you don't have any money in it, you're probably going to have a hard time convincing others to finance you. So if you think that what you can do is you're going to come up with the idea and do the hard work of running it, and somebody else is going to come up with all the money, unless you have a rich uncle, you're probably going to have a hard time finding that someone else. So just when you're thinking about how am I going to get the money, you think of founders, family, and friends, and that's slightly over 90% of all businesses, new startup businesses, that's where they get the money.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I think a lot of times people don't even consider that. There's so much involved in creating and starting and operating and running a business, and just when it comes to startup costs and just to get it up to a point where you can actually call it a viable business, there's so much involved in it, and that's why we encourage you to get this book. As you can see, the book just keeps on growing. I'm looking at I got three of them, right? I got three books, three different editions right here in front of me. I just had to grab the wrong one. Again, this book just keeps on growing with new principles all the time. Professor, does the next principle go back in?
We've got coverage of 90% of the funds come from founders, family, and friends. Where does the other 9% or 9.5% come from? Well, actually, 9.3% comes from what is called angels, business angels, investor angels. And that term is normally used for fairly well-to-do people who will generally invest up to $500,000 in a local business. Now, if they're here in Richmond, Virginia, don't think that they're going to be willing to invest in your business if it's in California or New York State. They probably are going to say, well, that's fine, go find somebody there, but I want to help out people in our immediate area. So that's another 9.3%. So where we're at now, we're at 99.8% of all funding for startup small businesses come from local business angels or founders, family, and friends. And one of the reasons I bring this up and spend some time, because I'm always asked that, where it comes from, but also because if you go to some colleges that are college courses on entrepreneurship taught by somebody who's never done it, very often they get all enamored with the famous ways of getting money. And those are, well, how did Apple Computer get their money? Where'd they get it from? Well, they got it from venture capitalists. And venture capitalists represent about 1,200 of those 600,000 a year. Or in other words, 0.2% of the money come from venture capitalists. So if you talk to somebody and they say, well, you really need to go to a venture capitalist, unless your business opportunity has truly explosive growth, such as Apple Computer did, or Apple, you know, computers, originally computers and now telephones, or Google or something like that, unless it has tremendous explosive growth, venture capitalists are just not a way to go. You'll also hear people who have never done it think that maybe an IPO, which is an initial public offering, has a possibility of helping you. Well, of the 600,000 every year, there is a total of 306, not 1,000, just 306 IPOs a year. And most of those go to existing businesses that have been very successful and are looking for fairly sizable money. So those are the ways that you can get money. There are two others, and while we're on the subject, I'll just go through that. One of them is called Regulation D. Regulation D is a private placement offering. It is the reason it's called Regulation D. It was Regulation D of the 1933 Securities Act. And in 1933, that was during the Great Depression, and a lot of businesses were trying to find money to start up and to stay, keep in business. And the options, the banks were no longer much of an option because most of the banks were in deep, deep trouble. The stock market really wasn't an option. One, it was in a bit of trouble. And secondly, the requirements to go on the stock exchange are absolutely horrendous. I mean, unless you've looked into doing it, you don't understand just how difficult they are. Today, I doubt if you could do a NASDAQ stock market offering, a IPO, for anything less than at least $750,000 of your own money, and there are no guarantees. I mean, so it is just... And the paperwork in it is just not to be believed. So they came up with this Regulation D, and it's something you can do. Today, when they originally did it, you could raise up to $2.5 million. And I did one, and you could raise back when I did it, you could raise $2.5 million in any calendar year. So let's say that you started in October, and by December the 15th, you'd raise $2.5 million. Well, then starting in January, you can raise another $2.5 million. That's been changed now so that you can raise up to $5 million in any 12-month period. So if you started in August, and you had the $500 million or $5 million raised by December, you couldn't even start again until not the next January, a month away, but a year away, a year and a month away. So that's the other one, and I did one of those. I was told it couldn't be done, but I needed some big money. I needed $5 million to start a business, and I thought that this was a way, but I didn't have, at that time, it was $250,000 just to start. And they told me, you better be prepared for another $250,000 before we get this thing done. So, in other words, $500,000. And we aren't going to guarantee anything. We aren't going to guarantee we'll raise one dime. So you're just rolling the dice, and the entrance to the game is $500,000, and we need to come up with snake eyes on the first roll. So, you know, that I couldn't do that. So I tried to do it myself and was successful. There is one other way now, and that is crowdfunding. And a lot of people do not think that's a legitimate way, but I'll tell you, it really is. Because crowdfunding is, let's see, 2015 was the most recent figures that I've seen. Crowdfunding raised $34 billion was raised by crowdfunding. Now, compared with the stock exchange, that's chump change. But compared with the amount of money needed to start a business, that's big money. Furthermore, you don't have to pay it back. So if you wanted to start a business and you went to Jawanza and said, hey, I need $100,000, are you good for half of it? And he said, yeah, I could come up with half of it, but what's my cut? How am I going to make out on this? And you better have a pretty good answer and a pretty sure answer. Otherwise, old, good old Jawanza, who is a peach of a guy, is likely going to say, well, fine, good luck, pal, but don't expect me. However, with crowdfunding, you could very likely raise that $100,000 if you have a good story and you know how to do it. And if you get my book, I tell you how to do it, absolutely step by baby step how to do it. And if you raise your $100,000, you don't have to pay any of those people back. Now, you might have to give out some perks. So let's say you were, what perks are, let's say that you're going to have you need $100,000 to start a candy store and make fudge. And so you might say, well, I'll give everybody who comes up with $1,000, I'll give them a pound of fudge. And, actually I'll give you a pound of fudge every month for 5 months. And that's called a perk. So, but in the scheme of things, it isn't even close to giving them back their $1,000. So what you're looking for is people who are like a angel investor, but is an angel investor in a very small way. So maybe they would give you $25, and maybe they'd give you $100. Well, if you needed $100, and you got 1,000 people to each give you $100, you got your $100,000. So that's the way that works, and it tells you how to do it in my book. I mean, truly step by step. And there's a way to do it. And there's a way I can tell you that if you're like me and you're not active on social media, you have no idea what that is, your odds of getting it done are poor, very poor. If you're like my daughter, who's a whiz on social media, her odds would be excellent.
Well, Professor, what about, I could hear somebody saying, well, what about philanthropists? You know, just somebody, you know, if that's the right way to put it in.
That's an angel investor. That's an angel investor. But as far as somebody who's going to give you the $100,000 and pat you on the head and say, you're such a peach of a guy, here's $100,000, go at it, that may happen. But that's what happens to people who have the good sense to pick rich uncles. And if you don't have a rich uncle that you picked at birth, your odds are poor.
Okay.
If you have a rich uncle that you picked at birth, your odds are probably still poor, just somewhat less poor.
They're no fools either, right?
No. They didn't get that way because they were fools.
Well, let's go back. Let's pick one that you touched on, IPOs. For those who might not know, an initial public offering, is that correct, when a company offers stock sells stock to raise money? Could you delve
right
into that a bit?
Well, an IPO, there's about, between 2007 and 2015, there was an average of 206 of them a year. Today, it's somewhat higher. Maybe there's twice that number. But as far as starting a business with an IPO, that's, frankly, it's just not an option. If you take a course in entrepreneurship and your professor says that's a really good option, I would suggest that you probably have a poor teacher because that person doesn't have a clue. So an IPO, you go to Morgan Stanley or one of the big or not so big stock market firms, and they put together a public offering for you. As I say, today it's probably going to cost you $750,000 or more to make the offering, and your chances of it being successful are a long way from 100%. Now, you know, if you happen to sell, a good example of what can happen is Amazon was supported by an IPO for years. They lost money every year for years and years. But it started when there was a tech bubble, and anything techie people were throwing money at it. And Amazon happened to start right then, and although they lost money, people liked the idea, particularly those who were on social media, and it was just kind of getting started then, thought that there's got to be a way that this will work. I mean, it sure beats tramping through stores to be able to order originally books online. Why do you want to go to a bookstore? If you get my book, which is Entrepreneurial Success, or the other one, Finding a Career for Life, you can go to Amazon and buy it. And if you buy it from Amazon, or you bought it from the local bookstore, or you bought it from me, it's the same blooming book. So it's not like a head of lettuce. Is the lettuce crisp? It's a book. And now, of course, they have gone into many, many other things. But for a long time, Amazon lost money every year for years. They didn't have a single quarter much. Well, heck, they didn't have a month where they made a profit. But people kept feeding the money through an IPO. I got to tell you, that is a very, very unusual story. If you told that story before Amazon, people would laugh at you and say, that's not possible. Well, it is possible because they did it. But it is very, very unusual. So an IPO for a startup business, I would suggest to you that it's just not possible, and in a realistic way. And the same story is true of venture capitalists. If you want to be one of 0.02%, that's what you got to be. Out of 600,000, you've got to be 1,200. That's what there was on average for 6 years, 7, 8 years. That's what there was.
And venture capitalists want a nice return too, correct? I mean, it's not going to come cheap.
Oh, they want a huge return. They want a huge return. Local angel investor might hope that he can garner a three times return, so he gives you $100,000 and he expects $300,000 back in 3 to 5 years. An IPO or a venture capitalist, if he gives you $100,000, he would expect a minimum of $1 million, more likely $2 million back in 3 to 5 years. And Ooh. And frankly, if he couldn't do that, there's no way he'd do it. So what they're looking for is the next Apple. And there are those out there, you know. Because what they do is they give you the money, and then in a few years they take you public with an IPO, and that's where they make their big home run.
You know what I used to wonder about was, you know, since we're just touching briefly on the IPOs and stuff, is any stock. Okay, so you take a company that's selling shares for chump change. I mean, you know, I'm wondering where are they making their money from, you know, because the share could be trading so low, you know, you're wondering, well, how is this benefiting the company?
You mean the people who are the stock company that is who is actually selling the stock, or the company that is receiving the benefits from the purchase of the stock?
The company that is actually maybe the parent company wouldn't be the word, but the company that's offering the shares.
Okay. Well, what they're hoping for is that they'll sell millions of them. And they often do. I mean, if you look at the amount of they, you don't see it on the news so much anymore. At one time you did. But if you look up and let's say the market went up by 10 points, how many shares of stock were traded that day? Well, the answer is billions. I mean, it's staggering. So that's where they do it. They sell stock for $10 a share or $5 a share, whatever it is, and they don't hope to sell 10,000 shares. They hope to sell 10 million shares.
Interesting. But I would think that would raise the price of the stock. I mean, it would.
No, it has nothing to do with the price of the stock.
Okay.
Absolutely nothing to do with the price of the IBM. I don't know what it is now, but at one time many years ago, one share of IBM stock was like $5,000. And they didn't need to sell the stock. They were doing so well, they didn't need to sell it. When they did need to sell it, if it was at $5,000, they split the stock, and they might have split it 100 to 1. So if they did that, well, then your one share of stock, which was 5,000 shares, was now 100 shares, and each of them was worth $50, still 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is more people who are able to cough up $50 than there were to cough up $5,000. What's that? The Wizard of Omaha. I just went blank.
Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett's company. It was a share of Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway. I don't know what it is now, but at one time, it was like $20,000 a share.
Hey.
Yeah, it wasn't for us poor folks, for their insurance.
Couldn't even get half a share.
Yeah, and in many cases, the minimum purchase was 100 shares. So you were talking about a fairly serious investor here.
Wow. Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're talking about a book that you've got to get. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. We're up to 105 business principles. I was going to ask you about, I had another question about crowdfunding and GoFundMe, but we don't have enough time for that. We'll pick that up
okay.
on the next, in the next show. Again, Professor comes every 2 weeks now, everybody. So if you thought you got to wait another month to hear the end of this conversation, no, you don't. Just just 2 weeks, if you can hang in there for 2 weeks. In the meantime, get the book. It's an awesome, awesome book. And, Professor, if you can tell them how they can get your book and even the autographed copy of
They can get the book from Amazon, and they have it. They have both of them. If you type in Amazon Books, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, it'll bring you right there. If you'd like a signed copy, you can get it from me directly at theroadtothetop.com. The only difference is they're both cases. They're 1895, and in both cases it costs you $4, $3.99 for shipping. The only difference is with me, I sign it. So if you get one from me, it'll be a signed copy. The other book, Finding a Career for Life, same way, and that is $9.95. Again, the same amount shipping, $3.99, and I sign the ones that people ask for me, and they get them from Amazon every bit as quickly, and but they're not signed. Other than that, everything's the same.
Wow, Professor, this is this is an awesome, awesome series we got going here with this information on entrepreneurship. Was there more to the financial? Finding financing.
Those are the six ways that you can finance a company, and in my view, there is four of them that are realistic: founders, family and friends, local angel investors, Regulation D private placement offering, and crowdfunding. And maybe next 2 weeks from now we can dive in more to crowdfunding, because that's something anybody can do. And I'll tell you how to go about doing it.
I'm looking forward to it. There are several different ways you can do that, and Professor is going to break that down, everybody. And again, this is something, I guess it's been around for a while, but it's just becoming popular again. Is that correct?
Well, originally the first crowdfunding ever done that at least that I know of was done in 1730, when the Bank of England darn near went broke, and a bunch of people got together and pooled their gold and backed the Bank of England. There was a run on the bank, and they backed it, and it didn't go under. Still there today. The second famous one was the Statue of Liberty. As everybody knows, the Statue of Liberty was given to us, given to America, United States, by France, but they didn't give us the pedestal upon which it sits, or the money to buy Bedloe's Island, where it sits in New York Harbor. We had to do that ourselves, and the federal government did not have the money. So 160,000 people in Western Europe and North America sent in nickels and dimes and dollars and pounds and francs and got the money to do it. And then away it went. And the first one that is happening nowadays is Indiegogo, which started in 2008. Kickstarter 2009, GoFundMe in 2010, MicroVentures in 2010. Now there's lots of them. Those are the kind of the early ones. So that's how they started. Some are trying to find money for businesses, and some are trying to find money for individuals who have had some very difficult times and are looking for funds. And there have been companies that have gotten millions for this, and some crazy ones. Yeah, there's a guy and his father who came up with a way of making beehive honeycombs for bees that were self-draining, so they didn't have to go in there and smoke out the bees and steal their honeycombs and so on. They just would drain them out. And that guy got hundreds of thousands of dollars for the idea. I think they were looking for like 40 or 50,000. They got three or four times of what they needed. So there's all kinds of things. People just, if it happens,
yeah, like,
to hit.
Because if there comes a point where you actually reach a goal, I'm sure, do they have to, we'll pick it up next time. Because I was going to ask you,
yeah,
if goal that's set and they exceed the goal, what happens to the additional money, you know?
Well, they get it.
But, okay.
But what happens if you don't exceed the goal? What then? Well, I'll tell
you
about that
point
in 2 weeks.
Good question. Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph Geiger, author of the awesome book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, Up to 105 Principles and Growing. We are going through the book principle by principle. And, again, he's written another book called Finding a Career for Life. You got to get that book, too. So, again, www.theroadtothetop.com. Okay, and definitely make sure that you get, you're going to need it. If you're an entrepreneur, you're going to need the cash flow forecast. That is a must. It is truly a must. You need that, okay? A lot of businesses fail within the first year. A lot of businesses fail within the second year. You can increase the odds. Okay, you want to stack the odds in your favor. One way to do that is to get the book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Professor, thank you for your time. Again, awesome interview. Great information. Thank you so much. I can't wait for the 2 weeks to fly by so that we can get back into this conversation. Thanks for being my guest again.
Thank you very much, Wanda. Have a good day.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Everybody, that's my special guest, Joseph. Again, you got to get the book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. This book just keeps growing and growing and growing. And again, if you're serious about becoming an entrepreneur, then you'll get this book. And somebody that's got over 50 years as an entrepreneur and is willing to definitely. Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Professor Joseph Geiger is the author, as well as the author of Finding a Career for Life. Awesome book. You know, a lot of times, especially when you're younger, you don't know what you want to do. You really don't know what you want to do. You're just out there, you know, you're trying this, you're trying that. Well, you want statistics that say, is the field that I'm going into, if I'm deciding to go to college, what is the ROI? What's going to be the return on the investment in that curriculum? Okay, if I spend X amount of money to go to college, and when I come out of college, I'm going to have these student loans, is the job that I get going to be actually worth it? So you definitely want to get this book because it's filled with statistics about if you go into this field, this is what you can expect, okay? And, I mean, there's just so much information in there. And one of Professor Geiger's principles is all decisions should be data-driven. When it comes to business, you need data, model. Whatever increases the odds of you being successful, you need information, okay, based on correct, verifiable data, okay? So definitely get this book, Finding a Career for Life, as well as Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Everybody, I want to thank you so much for your time. I don't take it for granted that you couldn't be doing something else. I truly appreciate your time. Thank you so much for tuning in with me today, being just enjoying the conversation that my person and Professor Geiger had. Again, he's going to be back in 2 weeks. Oh, by the way, got a show coming up for you on Thursday, all right, that you definitely don't want to miss. It's called Farmer to Farmer, Liberia at the Crossroads. Farmer to Farmer, Liberia at the Crossroads. And one of my special guests is going to be Pride Bass. You really got to tune into this show. You are going to be rewarded for the time that you take to listen to this show. A lot of very important information that you need to know about what's going on in Liberia, okay? They're at the crossroads, and there's some changes that you can help to implement, okay? There's some changes that you can actually help and be a part of the change and the growth in Liberia, okay? So definitely tune in this Thursday, all right? And that's going to be from 11 a.m., okay, till approximately 12, maybe a little after 12, okay? Don't miss that show. My special guest, again, is going to be Pride Bass. Make sure that you're here with us, okay? Thank you. My name is Juwan, so who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.